Chapter 10. My impression was that the rain intensified the moment I stepped out, but I wasn't going back for a hat or an umbrella. I ignored Parry and set such a furious walking pace that when I got to a corner and looked round, he was 50 yards behind. My hair was soaked, and water had already penetrated my right shoe, whose sole had a long-neglected gash. My anger came off in a cold glow, childishly undirected. Parry, of course, was to blame for coming between Clarissa and me, but my fury was for them both. He was the affliction she had failed to support me against, and for everyone and everything, especially the seeping rain and the fact that I had no idea where I was going. There was another thing, too, like a skin, a soft shell around the meat of my anger, limiting it, and so making it appear all the more theatrical. It was a quarter memory, a niggle, a faint connection rooted in a forgotten bout of reading, irrelevant to my purposes at the time, but lodged in me like an enduring fragment of a childhood dream. It was relevant now, I thought. It could help me. The key word was curtain, which I imagined in my own handwriting. And just as the rain on my lashes splintered and refracted the streetlight, so this word seemed to come apart, tugged this way and that by associations that lay just off the screen of recall. I saw a grand house, in long perspective, reproduced in the smudged black and white of an old newspaper, and high railings and perhaps some kind of military presence, a security guard or sentry. But if this was the house where the significant curtain hung, it meant nothing to me. I pushed on, past real houses, huge lit villas that rose above their high entry-phone gates, behind which I glimpsed carelessly parked cars. Such was my mood that I could consciously and pleasurably forget our own half-million-pound apartment and indulge the fantasy that I was a poor down-and-out, scurrying in the rain past the rich folks' houses. Some people had all the breaks. I'd wasted what few chances came my way, and I was nothing, and there was no one out here to care for me now. I hadn't tricked my own feelings like this since I was an adolescent, and the discovery that I could still do it gave me almost as much pleasure as a 5-minute mile. But then, when I felt for curtain again, there was no association at all, not even a shadow. And as I began to slow my pace, I thought how the brain was such a delicate, fine, filigreed thing that it could not even fake a change in its emotional state without transforming the condition of a million other unfelt circuits. I sensed my tormentor closing in on me just before I heard him half shout, half yodel my name. Then he called again. "Joe! Joe!" I realized he was sobbing.
"It was you! You started this! You made this happen! You're playing games with me all the time and you're pretending!"
He couldn't finish. I picked up speed again and I was almost running when I crossed the next street. His crying wavered with each jarring footfall. I was disgusted and frightened. I reached the other side and looked back. He had followed me, and now he was trapped in the centre of the road, waiting for a gap in the traffic. There was just a chance he could have fallen forward under a passing set of wheels, and I wanted it. The desire was cool and intense, and I wasn't surprised at myself or ashamed. When he saw my face turn toward him at last, he shouted a series of questions.
"When are you going to leave me alone? You've got me. I can't do anything. Why don't you admit what you're doing? Why do you keep pretending that you don't know what I'm talking about? And then the signals, Joe. Why do you keep on?"
Still trapped in the centre, his figure and his words obliterated at irregular intervals by the passing traffic, he raised his voice to such a hoarse screaming that I couldn't look away. I should have been running on, for this was the perfect moment to lose him. But his rage was compelling, and I was forced to look on, amazed, although I never quite lost faith in the redeeming possibility of a bus crushing him as he stood there, 25 feet away, pleading as he damned me. He uttered his words at a screech on a repetitive rising note as though a forlorn zoo bird had become approximately human.
"What do you want? You love me and you want to destroy me. You pretend it's not happening. Nothing happening. You fuck. You're playing. Torturing me. Giving me all your fucking little secret signals to keep me coming towards you. I know what you want, you fuck. You fuck. You think I don't? You want to take me away from...
I lost his words to a house-sized removal truck.
And you think you can take me away from him? But you'll come to me, in the end. You'll come to him, too, because you'll have to. You fuck! You'll beg for mercy, you'll crawl on your stomach!
Parry's sobs got the better of him then. He took a step toward me, but a car surging up the middle of the road forced him back with an angry blaring klaxon whose receding Doppler effect inverted his own sorry sound. At some point while he was shouting, I felt almost sorry for him again, despite my hostility and revulsion. But perhaps sorrow wasn't quite it. Seeing him stuck there, raving, I felt relieved it wasn't me, much as I do when I see a drunk or a schizophrenic conducting the traffic. I also thought that his condition was so extreme, his framing of reality so distorted, that he couldn't harm me. He needed help, though not from me. This in parallel with the abstract desire to see this nuisance guiltlessly obliterated on the asphalt. I benefited from a third current of thought and feeling while I listened to him. It was prompted by a word he had used twice, signals. Both times it caused the curtain that had troubled me earlier to stir and twitch, and the two words mated to spawn an elementary syntax. A curtain used as a signal. Now I was closer than before. I almost had it. A grand house. A famous residence in London, and the curtains in its windows used to communicate. The struggle with these fragile associations brought to mind the curtains in my study and then the study itself. Not its comfort, not the glow of its parchment lamps, or the glowing reds and blues of the Bokhara, or the submarine tones of my Chagall forgery, Le Poète Allongé, 1915, but the 100 feet or so of box files that filled 5 shelves, the whole of 1 wall. Black labelled boxes, jammed with clippings. And on the other side, by the south-facing window, the little skyscraper of a hard disk drive, where 3 gigabytes of data waited to help me build a bridge between this mansion and these 2 words. I thought of Clarissa with a sudden leap of cheerful love, and it seemed an easy matter to set right our row. Not because I had behaved badly or was wrong, but because I was so obviously, incontrovertibly right, and she was simply mistaken. I had to get back there. The rain was still coming down, but less heavily. The lights 200 yards up the road had already changed, and I could see from the disposition of the advancing traffic that within seconds, Parry would have his opportunity to cross the road. So I left him where he was, with his hands over his face, crying. He probably didn't see me as I turned and set off at a fast jog down a narrow residential road. And even if in his desolation he had had the heart to pursue me at this speed, I could have doubled round the block and lost him in a minute.